organizations, they always advertise they want curious employees. They want people to be curious in the workplace. But I always wondered, there has to be a limit of how much curiosity is too much.
This is Choose to Be Curious, a show all about curiosity. We talk about research and theory, but mostly it's conversations about how curiosity shows up in work and life. I'm your host, Lynn Borton. Welcome. Come, choose to be curious with us. The other day, I was having lunch with a good friend who also happens to be a gifted facilitator, coach, and workplace strategist. We were talking about leaders who fail, teams that fail, people who fail, and lamenting it often seems to boil down to them not knowing how to do the things they and everyone else know and say needed to be done. Take curiosity, for example. Business and popular literature are riddled with assurances that the best leaders are curious, that where curiosity goes, success will follow. I blithely tell people, choose to be curious. But the truth is, it isn't that simple. There is some skill involved. And not surprisingly, more than a few social constructs. So today, we're digging into the social side of curiosity at work. Phil Thompson cut his teeth in the banking world, spending more than a decade finding professional success. But the work didn't feed his soul, didn't exercise his intellect in the ways that he craved. So he made a shift that eventually earned him a PhD and brought him to research that examines micro-organizational behavior, things like organizational citizenship behavior, impression management, organizational politics, perceived organizational support, and curiosity. He's trying to understand how all those behaviors, particularly in combination with gender differences, influence employees' job performance. Phil is now a professor in the Department of Management at the Pamplin School of Business at Virginia Tech. I mentioned his research at that lunch with my friend, and she instantly recognized his work from the pages of Fortune or Harvard Business Review or maybe the Wall Street Journal. She wasn't sure which, and it could have been any one of them. Yep, I said, that's the guy. I'm going to be talking to him, the one trying to understand the social dynamics of curiosity at work. I am delighted to have Phil Thompson join me today. So welcome, Phil.
Lynn, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation. Been looking forward to this.
Me too. And I have to say, I know it's a little belated, but I want to say congratulations on this Ascendant Scholar Award that you got. I was personally thrilled that they thought of your work as having future continued productive applications. So bravo for that.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. It was a nice surprise. I love the folks at the Western Academy of Management, a really cool group out there.
That is very cool. So, okay, you came out of the business world. How did curiosity get into your mix of micro-organizational behaviors of interest?
You know, it's the wildest thing. So throughout my PhD program, I never considered curiosity as a topic. I had never really heard of it in terms of it being in the workplace. And one of our top journals had just called for papers. And Todd Kashtan, a guy that's been on your show.
Absolutely. I quote Todd a lot.
Yeah. He was one of the special editors. And I read the call. It was really, really interesting. And I was at a space where I had room to look at something different. And I just kept reading that call for papers. It kept coming up over the course of a month, and the deadlines kept getting extended. And then I started reading some of the social curiosity stuff and the social psychology literature, and I found it fascinating. So it took about 6 months, but I was all in and wrote a few papers with my co-authors. And since then, it's been the topic that interests me the most right now.
First of all, woohoo! I'm always excited when strong researchers come into this field, because you had actually written somewhere that despite all of the hype, there's kind of a dearth of evidence to support or cast doubt on the many claims that curiosity is associated with leader effectiveness. And I thought, well, good on him for calling this out, because when I first started on this subject, not a lot of people were talking about curiosity. And the 8 years that I've been doing this show, boy, the topic has just taken off.
Yeah.
But not always in very substantive ways. So I'm glad to hear that the call to bring the rigor spoke to you in this.
Yeah. And I think the call was mostly to bring it into the business, like into the management literature, because I think the work that's been done in psychology and social psychology has been really strong. I think it's been done really, really, really well. There just wasn't much work in the organizational sciences. So that's what the call was for. And since then, I mean, there's been 30, 40 papers that have come out, mostly from this special issue, but other top journals too. And I find it really, really cool stuff.
So one of the things that you sort of caution people is that we need to be thinking not just about the what of behavior, the nature, causes, consequences, but also the who, the characteristics of the people performing it, which is really what this sort of social take on curiosity in the workplace is about. Kind of spin that out. What's that mean to you?
As I get older, being vulnerable has become something that used to be really tough. And with a lot of practice, it's become easier for me to do. And being vulnerable is sometimes saying, I don't have the answer to something, or I'm not sure how that works. When leaders do that, on one hand, it signals to their followers, to their employees, that, hey, this person is like doesn't have it all figured out. They're humble. They're willing to listen to ideas. But on the other hand, I think employees want to have confidence in the person that they're following in terms of their careers and their career development, that they know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting balance. Our research has shown that it varies based on who's being vulnerable and how their employees perceive it.
Yeah. And this is the thing that I found so interesting and that, boy, was the topic of discussion at this lunch table with my friend, let me tell you. So talk about those findings, because I think these are really, I'm not sure that they will be surprising to people, but I think they will, I think they will crystallize some things for people. So please tell us what you found.
Yeah. So we found that, unfortunately, it adds to the body of research showing that there's a double standard in the workplace that generally hurts women much more than men. And we found that when employees are watching their leaders, their managers be curious in the workplace, when they watch their male leaders, they see it as this idea of, oh, this man is being super vulnerable. He's admitting that he doesn't know what the right route is going. We call it the male communality bonus, because there's an expectation that men less than women will be communal in the workplace. Whereas when women are doing communal things, such as being curious, being vulnerable, it's kind of expected. So therefore, their employees, it doesn't get much of a response. It's like, okay, this behavior is more expected from a female leader than a male leader, so it doesn't move the scale as much. In our research, we found that when men leaders were more curious in the workplace, their employees responded by feeling more psychologically safe, like feeling more safe to take risks in the workplace. Whereas when followers and employees of female leaders observed this curiosity in the workplace from them, they still felt more psychologically safe, but at a lower rate than followers of male leaders.
And is the baseline with male and female leaders the same?
Yeah, it's pretty close. Okay. Yeah, there wasn't much of a significant difference there.
So that's interesting. And see, this is what I mean. It's like, yeah, like we knew that, but getting the research to support it is in its own way chilling. So what about, did women have a... was it the flip side? If they were less curious, were they sort of penalized for that because it was expected of them? Or did you not, you weren't looking for that?
You know, a lot of my work has shifted towards gender differences in terms of, like, you look at the same behavior in the workplace and how it's viewed differently if a man does it versus a woman does it. In my PhD program, my cohort consisted of 4 people, and I was the only man in that group. And the other 3 folks are like 3 of my closest friends in the world right now, kind of going through the ups and downs of, you know, getting a PhD and all the life challenges with that. And all 3 of them had kids, like their first child, as we were in the PhD program. And so I started to see like some of my male privilege in terms of, things that they had to deal with that I didn't. And I think it really opened my eyes to just look like that being a more of a research area that I was interested in terms of gender differences in the workplace.
That's so interesting. I was a chief operating officer for a national nonprofit organization, but the rest of the C-suite was men. So we would get into these meetings and I would refer to it as me and the boys, you know, and these are lovely people, gifted, skillful leaders. I enjoyed working with them, but there were differences. There were definitely differences. Yeah. Yeah. So you also looked at what you came to describe as sort of the political skill of curiosity. And this to me has this interesting intersection with the gender stuff. I'm curious about what you think about the implications, but describe that research too as well, because this again was another one was like, yep, there it is. There it is.
Yeah. So this paper looked at the idea of it. Organizations, they always advertise they want curious employees. They want people to be curious in the workplace. Yeah. And I, for one, love curiosity. I love it. I think employees should do more of it. I think organizations should encourage it. But I always wondered, there has to be a limit of how much curiosity is too much. Because if an employee is being just super curious in the workplace of how they get their work done, they may be wasting time. Or at least there may be a perception that they're wasting time. So in this paper, we found that employees that were highly curious in the workplace, their supervisors actually perceived it to be a form of insubordination. Yep. And it's this idea of just get the work done. We have a status quo of how we want you to do it. Just do it. Like, you're wasting time going through A through Z, where you really could get the work done if you just went through this known way of getting it done through A through C. And so then we found that because the employees were perceived to be more insubordinate, that their supervisors didn't like them as much.
Sure. So it's that's disrespecting authority and messing with the status quo. And yeah, you can imagine that that wouldn't be so likable. So then what?
Well, so to take a step back from that, I'm not sure exactly if employees are wrong in that situation, if the organization is wrong in that situation, and who's right in that situation.
Yeah.
And what we found was employees who were more politically skilled, those who kind of could read a room from a social standpoint, those that were socially astute, those that could make their arguments in a very sincere and authentic way, they didn't seem to suffer from this issue. They could be highly curious in the workplace, and their supervisors didn't perceive them to be insubordinate at all.
You're listening to Choose to Be Curious. I'm your host, Lynn Borton, and I'm joined today by management professor Phil Thompson. We're talking about the social side of curiosity at work. But there was more to that, right? Because then there was, if they could do it in a sort of politically savvy way and be perceived as constructive, right?
Yeah.
So what is that? Like, what's that secret? Because that seems to me to be really important.
Yeah, this was a cool thing. We actually got the idea from the editor. And the example that the editor, Evan Pullman at Wisconsin, brought up was, think about a student in class that is always raising their hand, asking questions, and being curious, essentially. And, you know, we think about it in a way that this student is going to ask questions that's going to move the conversation forward, to help the group think deeper and more nuanced in terms of the topic. But what about the student that is asking questions that was already addressed in the reading? Mm-hmm. Or the student that shows up late and they're asking questions that we already talked about 10 minutes ago? Or they're asking the same question that keeps the group in the same space? So we kind of landed on this idea of constructiveness of the curiosity. And this was like the instruction of the paper, is that if the employee is offering curiosity that's constructive, it's useful, it's helping the group move forward towards fixing a goal or working on a work problem, then it's a good thing. Organizations should not push back on that. The managers are in the wrong there. However, if the employee is pushing curiosity in a way that is not constructive, it's not being helpful to their performance or to the group's performance, then maybe the organization is right in terms of pushing back and not completely endorsing or supporting that employee's curiosity.
So one of the things that you had included in that distinction between constructive and unconstructive curiosity was the complexity of the questions. And I thought this was actually really interesting, that sort of harder questions, things that didn't have ready answers, you put them in the constructive category, and easy questions went in the unconstructive category. And that's like they didn't do their homework. Is that what, right? But I was reassured that complex questions fell into the constructive category, because sometimes you worry that, you know, complicated questions make people cranky, right?
Yeah.
And maybe don't get perceived as constructive, but you didn't find that, or you didn't divide them in that way. That was actually interesting to me and exciting to see.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a really good point. This idea of complexity, I think it's okay to ask complex questions. I think it's perfectly okay to throw things out there to have the group to ponder on. And every suggestion, every piece, like every action of curiosity doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be, here's a magic bullet. But sometimes in meetings, past research has shown that people feel pressure to say things. They feel pressure to just throw out an idea, especially if they haven't said much throughout a meeting. So our research suggests be thoughtful, you know, and also some of our other research has shown that curiosity from leaders kind of helps employees see the signal that it's okay, it's safe to take these kind of risks. So when you put those two things together, if the leader is out there being curious, admitting that they don't know what the right route to go is, let's work together to figure that out. I think it helps create a culture and an environment where there is a safety there, but the constructiveness of the idea and the constructiveness of the curiosity, I think, will really move that car further down the road.
You have a nice way of putting it. I forget where I saw this. I read a lot of your work in the last couple of weeks. But
you must have got a lot of good sleep then.
No, not at all. This was good. I've been churning on this for ages now. But you just have this nice line about asking the right question at the right time. And I thought that's the elegant distillation for everybody, leaders, employees, people on the streets, people at the lunch table with their friends, thinking about what's the right question at the right time, which means, as you say, not just saying something to say something, but really thinking about what is it that I want to know that I don't know that would advance this conversation, that would advance our exploration. I really, really like that. So I want to know, if when you look back at your previous work, what do you know now that you would have liked to have known, and what might you have done differently with the benefit of your research in your hind pocket in your previous life?
Oh gosh, Lynn, you've only got a 28-minute podcast. This could easily be 4 hours, just that question. Oh my goodness. So this idea of impression management was really big for me when I worked. In organizations, there was this idea that you needed to put a certain version of yourself forward to move forward in organizations. And what I've learned as a researcher is it's okay to not always have all the answers. In fact, sometimes admitting that can really cut through the tension in a room, especially when you're leading the room, you're leading a research group, or if I'm consulting with organizations and I admit that, I think it's like sometimes it just brings down the temperature in the room that, okay, mm-hmm. we're actually here to work. We're not here to validate one camp's ideas or not. And so I think back to my time when I worked full time in corporate, that was something I wish I would have done more of in terms of leading that way. And that probably would have led my employees to feel more comfortable to take risks.
I appreciate you saying that. And it resonates for me because, you know, I sort of worked my way up through this organization where I ended up as the COO. And you kind of forget that people are looking to you as a role model and for signals, and that they read things into sometimes the smallest things, and that modeling things like constructive curiosity as opposed to performative curiosity or aggressive curiosity, it really does matter. And it really does make a difference in what people think is okay in the workplace, what they're willing then to try and do. I hear that. I hear that.
Accepting feedback too, and being open to feedback. Mm-hmm. You know, we all had a tendency to, you know, somebody like gave you feedback, not really appreciate the idea that it's easier not to say anything. And that if somebody is actually speaking up and sharing with you ideas that could make them feel more comfortable, they're probably not just speaking for themselves. They're probably speaking for multiple, if not more, other employees that feel the same way as well.
Interesting. So where's your research going next?
Oh, I've got more ideas than I have time. But the good thing is I'm always blessed to work with really good co-authors, and now I'm working more with students. This idea of curiosity is something I think I'm going to stick with. You brought up just a couple of really thoughtful questions of where our research should go next. And in our papers, we can only really tackle a handful of questions.
Right.
But once you answer those questions, it leads to more questions. So right now we're looking at like how organizations can create cultures of curiosity, and how employees can receive signals that, hey, my organization or manager actually does appreciate when I'm being curious in a workplace. Because in the one paper we talked about, there's a disconnect between organizations saying that they want more curiosity, and then sometimes the managers being like, hey, just get the work done. You're being a little bit too curious here. So how can we kind of fix that disconnect where employees actually feel comfortable and they feel like it's a lower risk to actually be curious in the workplace?
Well, and to go back to Todd Cashin at the top of this conversation, I mean, he's done really interesting work in the different ways that curiosity shows up. And one can imagine that there are flavors of curiosity that are perceived as more constructive in the business world than others, but sort of shape-shifting and right-sizing it and understanding the nuance and getting some fluency around it, I guess is sort of what I'm thinking, is that now we use this one big word, it means a lot of different things, and it means a lot of different things to different people. And so helping to kind of find that nuance, I think that would be a great contribution to the field.
Yeah, because we all show up differently. I mean, think about, you know, how we were all raised differently. Sometimes as kids, curiosity was encouraged. Other times, kids, they ask questions. It's like, you know, the parents are, or the teachers are, because I said so. Mm-hmm. And that kind of shuts down the curiosity. So I think people show up in the workplace at various stages of how open they are in terms of other people being curious. And I think that also influences if people interpret curiosity as a threat, as, hey, are you questioning me? Which I don't think should be the way. I think, obviously, I'm a pro curiosity person here. I'm on your team. I'm on team Lynn and curiosity. But also, I'm a realist that there's so much loss in interpersonal communication beyond what's said. Like, we interpret things, and sometimes we interpret things wrong in terms of people's intention. I take the position that when people are being curious, they're doing it from a well-intentioned place. And where it goes wrong is how people interpret it. And we can sometimes put that blame on the communicator, but I put most of the blame on the interpreter and how they interpret people's well-intentioned curiosity.
I think that's a really interesting observation. And I think it goes really full circle to your attention to those organizational behaviors, right? And what's the culture about the generosity of intention, or how the organizational behaviors play out, intention notwithstanding, because we all know what road is paved with good intention. But nice. You're also involved in what seems to me to be a really important project in terms of feeding the pipeline. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, I've been a benefit of the PhD Project, which is an organization that was set up by KPMG a couple of decades ago. And the goal is to get more underrepresented minorities into faculty positions in the business school. The PhD Project, I think one of the undercurrents there is curiosity for people who are just interested and thinking about a PhD. So they fly out a couple hundred people who are just thinking about PhDs. And there's panels of people like me, also people who are currently students, and just talking about, hey, this is how I worked out to study for the GMAT. This is how I made the transition of getting paid six figures to living on a graduate school stipend for 4 years. This is what a career looks like once you get your PhD. It's a no pressure thing. And they're just bringing people out there to learn more about if they want to go down that route or not. It's helped improve the retention rates for underrepresented minorities to actually get through the program. So anybody thinking about possibly pursuing a PhD, please check out the website of phdproject.org. It is probably the biggest reason why I was able to get through my PhD program and also my early career as a professor. And it's just a phenomenal organization.
Okay. Before I let you go, are you game for my big jar of wannabe analogies?
Let's do it, Lynn.
Okay. Okay.
I listened to a couple of episodes and I'm like, I'm going to do this. I'm here.
All right. Okay. So I am traveling, so I don't have the jar with me, but I had audience members send me words. So I just went to one and I pulled the first three, and yours is rainbow. How is curiosity like a rainbow? Mine is sand. And then I have one for the audience. So you want to go first, or you want to want me to do this?
I think I'm going to follow everybody else and let you go first.
Okay. Okay. So how is curiosity like sand? I'm going to say that curiosity is like sand in that it gets everywhere. It's kind of sticky. It can be a little uncomfortable. It can sort of chafe. On the other hand, you can build amazing things with it. So those are the ways I think curiosity is like sand.
Okay.
How is curiosity like a rainbow?
Curiosity is like a rainbow. So when I think about rainbows, they come in various levels of how vibrant they are. They can be dull. Yeah. They can be as vibrant as they, you know, as you see them in coloring books. And I think curiosity is that same way too. Sometimes curiosity starts inside our head, and other people don't necessarily see the full development of the idea. But once you put curiosity out there, you help, like you allow others to kind of help shape the idea. It can become as vibrant as the most colorful rainbow.
I love it. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And audience, yours is star. How is curiosity like a star? Let me know. Social media, hashtag analogy. Well, Phil, thank you so much for this. This has really been great. And I'm just really excited to see what you do next with this subject.
Thanks, Lynn. This has been a lot of fun. I appreciate the invite.
You've been listening to Choose to be Curious. I'm your host, Lynn Borton. Thanks for joining us here today. You can find all my shows on my website at choosetobecurious.com. I hope you follow me here, there, and on social media at Choose to be Curious, where you can share your star analogy, hashtag analogy. Many thanks to my guest, Phil Thompson. Links to his research on my website. Thanks, too, to Sean Ballack for our theme and other music. I hope you'll join us again next time. Until then, choose to be curious constructively.